Hey, everybody, welcome to the podcast. Before I get into who my guest is this week, very excited to announce that Wednesday, June 15th, I'm going to be doing stand-up on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert on CBS, 11:35 p.m. Eastern Time. Late Show, Stephen Colbert. I will be standing up telling jokes, 11:35 p.m. Hope you guys can check it out. Tell your friends, family, your milkman. Spread the word, DVR it, email people, take out ads. Anyway, hope you guys can check it out. I'm really excited about it. And my guest this week, my friend and comedian Michael Ian Black, one of the original founders of The State, great comedy sketch group that was on MTV. You've seen him on Ed. You've seen him on Viva Variety, Stella, The Jim Gaffigan Show, in the movie Wet Hot Summer. Really cool conversation with him about his childhood. Interesting. His event happened with his mom when he was 9, which you have to tune in to hear. His comedy, how he has come to write children's books. Really cool conversation and very funny. Great guy. Enjoy it. And check me out on June 15th on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Thanks. So here we are in our little room doing my podcast with Michael Ian Black. Old-time friend, we've worked together, paths have crossed here and there and everywhere. Welcome.
Thank you.
Michael has a special out called Noted Expert on Epics.
That's right.
And really a slacker. So also has the on the Jim Gaffigan Show, on the show Another Period, which is really funny on Comedy Central. You have a book coming out, a children's book about Trump, July 5th.
That sounds right.
And you are, and I mean this as a compliment, my Dick Cavett. In the sense of, like, you sort of, you're obviously you're a comedian, you're a sketch performer, but you're very, very well-read, very well-informed, and just your approach to things is quite smart and funny and unique and sort of a man about town, if
you
will.
Well, thank you. I mean, I don't see how being compared to Dick Cavett could be considered anything but a compliment.
Well, I didn't know. Like, I was thinking about it. I'm like,
does anybody hate Dick Cavett? Well, like, that motherfucker Dick Cavett.
He is a prick. He gets drunk and he's a complete dick to people. I was thinking about it, and I've known you, but then when you really start to kind of dig into, you know, getting ready to talk to you, I'm like, Jesus Christ, like, I don't know if this guy sleeps. You have like 6 children's books. What is the one, Chicken
Cheeks?
Chicken Cheeks? What is
That's about animal butts. That was the first one. That was my first foray into the world of children's publishing.
Now, I know that the motivation from what I read was that you were reading, and I had the same thing reading to my son, and you're reading these books and you're going, and if I have this wrong, you tell me, but these aren't very good. I
could exactly.
And so
it was literally, I could write a book at least as terrible as this. And if that's the case, I should be doing that because I could make some money.
Brian Regan has this thing. He's reading to his kid and he goes, these books, he goes, and they sell millions. He goes, so I wrote a book, The Clock, The Big Red Clock, The End. And that's the whole bit.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that'll be a New York Times bestseller. So we'll talk about the special in a minute, but the chicken cheek, how did that come about? What was the...
Well, my kids were at an age then when they found butts funny. I mean, they still do. We all do.
Yes.
But, so I just started coming up with different animal butts and funny ways to say animal butts. And then when I came up with what I'm going to consider the climax of the book, which is duck-billed platypus gluteus maximus, I was like, I have a book here.
that's quite a revelation. So how cool was it for your kids when you started reading your books to them, or they started?
They don't
reading?
Care. They could care less.
Do they give you thoughts or comments on? My son sometimes will like look at something and go, that's pretty funny, or you should do that more or something.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, they're highly critical. I don't really show them much. Like, I don't really...
Yeah.
I don't really say, this is dad's work. Like, yeah, it would have been weird if my dad had come home from work and had been like, you want to see what I was working on today?
I know. I had a guy... It's funny you said that, because I was working at a club, and then I happened to be you know, in the area. And he goes, hey, why don't you come over Friday and, like, hang out? And I'm like, no. He goes, what? He goes, you thought I was... I go, let's pretend you're an accountant and I'm an accountant. And I call you and say, hey, on Saturday, it's tax season. Why don't you come over and sit and watch me do taxes? You'd be like, what are you... He could not comprehend that the last place I wanted to be was in a comedy club or a performance space. It's like, it's, and so it's just, my son, you know, he's come to like the Daily Show and see tapings or Colbert Report, stuff like that. But, and also comedy clubs just aren't an appropriate place for kids. He's, you know, he's 13, going on 14. But I got to think that there's something interesting to them about what we do.
I think there might be. But, for me, I'm interested in, shielding is too strong a word, but from not overexposing them to this business.
Yeah.
Because they, anything that I'm going to bring them to is going to be like the icing stuff. You know, it's going to be like a premiere or like a performance. It's not going to be like the drudgery. It's not going to be like, hey, you want to spend 6 hours with dad traipsing around the city going on auditions for Dial Soap. It's not going to be that.
You don't think that they would love that?
So
I remember when we first met, you said, if I could just get a Dial Soap commercial, I'm done. I take my residuals and I move to Tahiti.
And I would have.
Well, it's funny because I think my first son's real encounter with like celebrity was he used to toss the football around with Jon Stewart before the Daily Show because Jon has this little routine, right? And he thought it was cool. And then after he did it a few more times, he thought, yeah, I'm just tossing a ball with Jon Stewart, right? And then he met Bill Clinton at the Daily Show, who happened to be there, and Bill came through. And by the way, I don't know if you've met him, but
I've never met Bill Clinton.
When you do, thank you. We're having tea delivered to us by my lovely wife. Michael's allergic to my wife. That's why he just sneezed. Thank you. You're the best wife ever. And when Bill Clinton meets you, it sounds cliche, but you do, like, he looks in your eyes and you want to sleep with him. It's like crazy how he just...
So wait, your son fucked Bill Clinton?
Yes.
That's hard. Crazy.
And Bill called me and asked me for more, and I said,
that's crazy.
My son's busy showering with Mr. Sandusky. He's not available right now. But my son met him, and I thought about it. It's very funny you said that, because I thought, like, I wonder if my son thinks, like, this is just how it is.
Right.
Like, you just hang out on a TV show. And
with presidents?
With presidents and, you know, big, you know, the star of the show and all that stuff. And so, but I understand what you mean. And I don't know, personally, if my son doesn't have the personality to be a performer anyway. He's more like...
Yeah, my kids don't either, I don't think. But I definitely don't... Hmm. I don't push them in that direction, but I don't dissuade them either. I mean, if they had really wanted to do it, I wouldn't have stood in their way. But at the same time, like, if you want to be a performer, as you know, nobody's going to stand in your way. So it's, you're just going to do it. So, you know, my input or lack of, if they really wanted to do it, wouldn't have been a factor anyway. But at this point, it doesn't seem like either of them has any interest in it, which is totally fine with me.
Yeah, and it does sort of pick you. I mean, in my case, I was a lawyer and banker on Wall Street doing corporate merger deals and started writing as a hobby, and then...
You're an idiot.
I know.
You're a fucking idiot.
I know. I used to own a beautiful two-bedroom co-op.
What's the matter with you?
Seven blocks up to my wife. We went... I know.
I mean, you could have just kept doing that. At this point, you'd be retired.
Oh,
I know. Now you could be doing exactly whatever you wanted to do, but with a financial cushion.
I know.
You're a moron.
I fucking hate you.
I don't think I knew that about you.
Why do I fucking have you on my show? I hate you. Carol, can we end this? No, I...
And you hated it, right? You were doing it. You were miserable.
Well, what happened was it's not like people write in movies like, you wake up one day, I'm going to pursue my dream. And turn, it's like, I started writing short films. I was in law school in DC and I started writing short films. I don't make this about me, but short story, I was writing short film ideas, and then I made some short films, and one of them got into the Aspen Comedy Festival.
And that was the end.
And then I go and I lie and I say, oh, I'm going home because my mother's sick and I'm in Aspen. And then I end up at a luncheon for young filmmakers with Spike Lee, the Hudlin brothers, Albert Brooks,
wow,
and Woody Allen. I'm like, what the fuck am I doing here? Like,
right.
I'm supposed to be literally back at the firm doing a merger deal. And then I wrote jokes, and then I met Leno, at a private function, and I said, I don't know what, I'm a lawyer, and this is all I'm going to do the rest of my life, so I don't know what I'm going to do with these. You can have them. And he took them, and then he called me the next week, and he hired me to start sending jokes in for the Tonight Show monologue, and then he did one of my jokes for $50, and it was just like, and then I started doing stand-up in this, like, secret double life thing that I was living, where I was literally, we have a dinner break at 7 o'clock at the firm, and I would go to these dive bars to do, you know, open mic nights or little alternative rooms or whatever. And then I'd, in my little
business suit,
and then I'd sneak back and I'd work all night. And I kept trying to suppress it. And then at some point.
And then you came out. At some point you came out.
I came out and I said I had to do it. And then I unraveled my life and I totally fucked everything up. But,
but look how happy you are.
Yeah. Well, but it's funny because your podcast that you're doing now, focuses on sort of people's process, and what prompted you to sort of, I mean, because you've done several different ones, but what prompted you to sort of go in that direction right now?
Well, the podcast is called How to Be Amazing, and it is, that's the premise of the show. I interview people from all fields and really talk about, hone in on process. Generally, it's a creative process, but not necessarily. Like, I just interviewed the guy, Wayne Pacelli, who's the head of the Humane Society of America. And, you know, like, animal welfare has been a passion of his entire life. And that's what we talked about.
Right.
And I'm constantly and have always been interested in why people do what they do and how they do it.
Yeah, me too.
And you're a good example of it. I mean, you're a good example of somebody who gave up a lucrative career to pursue a very uncertain future because you had no choice.
Yeah, and I thought I did. I thought I was like, well, I'll just... I literally stopped for a while, and then I was like 2 months later back performing like an alcoholic looking for a drink.
Yeah.
You know who you should interview? Try to... if you
don't tell me what to do. Don't you dare tell me what to do.
Drink that... First of all, drink that tea with your other hand. Secondly, cheek butt guy. Interview a professional wrestler.
Yes, I would love to.
I interviewed Stone Cold Steve Austin. I thought it was going to be... I'm not a big pro wrestling person, and it was in... it actually was in a hotel room in California, and as he's coming up to my hotel room, I'm like, what if he goes into a roid rage and rapes me? Like, I have no...
And rapes me? Yeah, well, that's what you were worried about?
I was worried about being raped by a... I don't know why. Not that I'm saying I'm hot or anything. I'm just saying...
No,
you know.
Look. If you telling this story was your way of fishing for compliments... You're hot enough to get raped, okay? Paul, look at me. You're hot enough to get raped. I want you to know that.
You. All right, put your shirt on. and what they go through, what he went through to build that and find that character.
Oh, my God. I would be fascinated.
Is exactly what performers and comedians go through to find their voice. He would go from town to town, podunk town, working these little venues, and he'd be, I think early on he was like the pretty boy or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he said we would do the show, and he'd listen to the audience and how they were reacting in the show. And then if it didn't work, they change things. And it's exactly what you do.
I'm sure.
It was utterly fascinating. I thought it ended up being a two-part interview. If you can get somebody, I can introduce you to Mick Foley, actually. I had him.
He'd be a great guy to talk to. I also just met John Cena. He's probably too busy to do it. But he'd be an interesting guy to talk to. Any of those guys. I find that fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, that's the great thing about this long form, you know, is just sort of... I had my acting coach on. He didn't want to do it. He talked for almost an hour and a half because I wanted people to really understand what acting was, real acting was about. Like, as opposed to from a critic. I'm doing air quotes on a podcast, but...
And we could hear it in your voice. We could hear it.
And nobody knew this guy. And he said, nobody knows me. I go, it doesn't matter. The point is I want people to understand process... and what people do, who they think they know, and also expose people, like you just mentioned, the animal welfare person, to people that they don't know that I think they should. And I got more feedback on that than probably most of mine, because people are like, well, that was really cool. Like, I love watching movies, and I love watching actors, but I don't understand. But anyway, let's talk about the special. You have a thing in the special a bit about the viability of a fetus and a baby, which is absolutely hilarious, and people have to watch it. But it's a really clever take, and the build of it and the writing of it's really sharp. And then you're talking about your wife and the Zen moments with your wife. And Are you covering a lot of different grounds, political, social, personal, or what are you getting into these days?
It's mostly personal, a little bit observational. It's interesting when it talk sort of, I'm still in the Stone Cold Steve Austin thing.
Hmm.
Because I think people inherently or innately know that comedians, successful comedians, do jokes that only they can do. They have their voice, and you can't. A good joke is a joke that only I can do, or a good joke is a joke that only you can do.
Right.
And so much of the comedian's process and journey is finding those jokes and that voice.
Right.
Like that's 80% of it, I think. And it never stops. For me, it never stops. And I came into comedy fairly late in terms of when most people start. I was in my 30s. I was doing sketch comedy before that and had a career before that.
Right.
But I hadn't done stand-up. And so much of what I've been doing internally is trying to figure out who I am as a stand-up.
Right.
And it's taken me, as it takes all comics, years to figure it out. And what I've learned is I'm best at telling personal stories.
Hmm.
But I want to find ways to expand that and to do more than that. I'm not a political comedian. I'm not Jon Stewart, who's brilliant at it.
Hey, look at me. You're better than Jon Stewart. You're good enough. You're smart enough.
Doggone it. You're better than Jon Stewart. Clearly, I'm better than Jon Stewart. But I wanted to... I personally am very interested in politics, and I'm very interested in culture and where the two meet. And I've wanted to do more topical political material, but every time I try, it's terrible. Every time I try.
I don't necessarily agree with you because I've seen it. By the way, Kevin Allison did my podcast, and you did his Risk show, and people should go on YouTube and watch your performance at Brown.
What did I talk about?
It's this great story about you went to Amsterdam
on your
honeymoon, and it's just great. I know exactly what you're talking about because I think when we start doing stand-up, and I want to, in a minute, it's exactly one of the things I want to talk about was sort of your expanding beyond sketch, and the state is and was brilliant. I want to talk about that in a minute. But you start out because I think it's so crazy that you're up there in front of people trying to get them to like you that you immediately go to things, I think, in the beginning that you think everybody's going to like.
Right.
So I'm going to talk about water because everybody knows about water.
I'm going to talk about sex.
We're talking about sex. We're going to talk about dating. We're talking about going to McDonald's, right? And then at some point, I think if you're good and you're trying to approach this from an artistic point of view, you go, well, fuck that shit. Everybody's talking about that.
Exactly.
But you can't. It's not natural to just go up and peel yourself open. You need to, and for some people it's a year, some people it's 8 years. At some point you get to that point, I think the emotion drives the writing. In other words, you get to the point emotionally, you go, you know what, I think either consciously or subconsciously, you go, fuck it. I don't give a shit. I cannot talk about French fries anymore, and I got to talk about this other thing. And I think you can through personal experiences. I had this experience about literally the next morning after the San Bernardino bombing, and I got on the subway, and the door opened, and there were two women in full burkas. I mean full. And I'm not proud of this, but I'm talking about it because I think if I felt it,
You punched him in the face, didn't you? You punched him in the fucking face.
I punched him in the twat. It was two women. I punched him right in the cunt. You don't wear that. This is America, man, and we're going to make America great again. Can I write the foreword to your children's book? I literally, for a minute, thought, like, terrorists. Mm-hmm. And I'm not happy about that. But I said, I got to talk. Now, I don't think all Muslims are terrorists, and I understand.
Just most.
But I also did think, like, I don't know, maybe I'd just that one morning I wouldn't wear the burqa because everybody's a little on edge, you know?
But kudos to them for having the courage of their convictions.
Right. But that's something that I'm talking about through my own personal prism.
Yes.
So I think you can do it. And I agree with you. I'm in the same place. Like, I'm not really interested in being a soapbox comedian where I'm, like, trying to change everybody from their point of view. I mean, I have mine and you have yours. But it seems from what I saw of the special... you're doing that through the personal.
With the abortion stuff, like, I do, I don't know how long, 5, 6, 7 minutes on abortion.
Which is ballsy because, like, that's one of those hair trigger words. You know what I mean? People immediately sort of, it's reflexive, you know? It's sort of.
And I wanted to, that was the only time I think I've ever successfully sat down, written something, got up on stage, and had it work.
Really?
I mean, it's evolved since I started it, but like from the first time I sat down and wrote it and started working on it, like it's pretty much worked. But what was interesting to me, from what was revelatory to me about myself in talking about it, was I declare myself in the piece to be pro-choice, but then I said, and this is true, I have a lot of sympathy for pro-life people because I do. But like, it took me to sort of get up on stage and start talking about it before I even sort of admitted that to myself.
So, you know, that's a ballsy position to take because especially having worked on The Daily Show and The Colbert Report and now The Late Show with Colbert, you know, our audiences are pretty liberal.
Yeah.
And they like to cheer, you know, they like to root and cheer,
yeah,
right?
Everybody likes the echo chamber.
And they like their star, whether it's Stephen or you or Jon Stewart, to sort of echo what they, so to be up there, and it's still, I don't know, for me it doesn't change, there are moments where you just don't want to take a position that you know the rest of the room isn't going to go for. Do you get pushback from the audience when you say, well, look, I understand the pro-life side of it?
No, I haven't. I think partly because I start off by making fun of my own side. Like, I talk about being pro-choice and then I make fun of pro-choice people. And I say, I have sympathy for pro-life
meaning
people.
Meaning the viability.
The whole thing. And then I make fun of both sides and in what I think is not a cheap way.
Right.
And I haven't gotten pushback. I mean, I've gotten pushback on certain things before. And that's fine. I always welcome that.
I think people are reasonable. I'm talking about Trump lately and just like, and my point of view is, look, it was a matter of time before someone finally came to the forefront who fulfilled the goal of breaking the establishment, right, and being the outsider. And it just happened to be him.
I know, but why did it have to be that guy?
I know, but you know what? I do think that Americans, particularly, are fundamentally decent people who will give you a break. If he could just say, I don't really know a lot about this, but I will learn. I wouldn't vote for him because I'm not on that side of the fence politically, but I think a lot of us would be like, okay. Like, I think where he lost me in a larger concept was, why would you question that I need to know anything? Fuck you. You're the liberal. Like, who does that?
Nobody, no sane person does that who wants to run the country and therefore the world.
Right.
Well, what you've said is really interesting, and if he were to show any humility at all, I think he would skyrocket in the polls. But he's incapable of it. I mean, his lack of humility is what got him to this point. But it's also his.
It's Greek mythology. The thing that makes you great is your undoing. Yeah.
I mean, talk about hubris. But there's also just his blatant racism.
Right.
That's what's so troubling.
Yeah.
Is just a guy going up there and saying, yeah, I'm a fucking racist, and I want to be president.
Right.
And people are like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with that.
And all the guys with the camouflage hats and the Make America Great t-shirts come out, and they're like, finally, a guy that speaks our language. But I just want, one question and one debate, and I walk out. And my question to Trump is this. I've been to your hotels. They're fine. I understand you're building a new casino, $1 billion, couple of billion, whatever, in Las Vegas. I have some thoughts on how your casinos and hotels could be better, especially I'm a touring comedian. I've stayed in a lot. I would like to take over the construction of your project, soup to nuts. Never built anything before. Don't have any experience with budgets. Just let me have the $1 billion.
But I've been in a lot of casinos. I know a lot. I have hundreds of friends who go to casinos. Great people.
I've taken shits on toilets, so I know how those work. And you just come in and for the grand opening. How would you be with that? And he go, are you out of your fucking mind? And then you go, well, then why is America any different? Why the fuck? By the way, I'm not even asking for access to the nuclear fucking button. I'm just right. asking to ask us.
I just want to know. I just want to place the baccarat tables.
Right, and pick wallpaper. So tell me, you wrote this book, Navel Gazing, which people can get on your website. It's a collection of essays. And, you know, you talk about yourself and your stinky feet and your mom having cancer, and she's well now, right? She's,
well is relative. She's yeah. alive, which yeah. for her is well.
Yeah. How old is she?
73.
Okay. Yeah, my mom's 80, 88 and still kicking. But, wow.
You're much older than me, though.
Yeah, yes, I'm 82 myself. my mother had me when she was one. Did you, in writing about that, and you talk about, you know, your mom, your parents divorced, your mom came out, and I've never asked anybody this question, and if you don't want to answer, you don't have to. When you realize as a kid that your mother or your father is gay, I don't know, tell me how old you were, if you don't mind, and what effect does that have on you at that age?
What's interesting to me in retrospect about it was I was 5 or 6. Mm-hmm. And
but did she tell you at that age that she was
She never sat down and explained it, but I distinctly remember walking into her bedroom one morning when after my parents had split up and she had moved in with her partner and they were in bed together. They weren't doing anything. They're just like, you know, sleeping and having a conversation with them. And I remember my emotional state about it, which was, it didn't register with me at all. There was nothing.
Did you think there was a, did you even understand?
No,
sex at
I didn't.
I don't remember understanding sex. At
I knew
age.
That there was, I mean, if I can place myself back then, I don't know that I can accurately, but I felt like I knew there was an adult world that I didn't understand.
Right.
I knew adults did things that I didn't quite get, and I knew they were in bed together and that meant something, but the only thing that registered to me about it was that the woman that she was with wasn't my dad. Not that there was anything particularly weird about two women being together.
Oh, I get it. Yeah. Okay.
And I'm assuming that was just a function of age. I was just too young to know that that was out of the ordinary.
You know, men and women together, women and women together. Men,
I didn't,
men
it, together, it, yeah. I didn't even do that much math. It was just like, oh yeah, this person, you know what I mean? This, it was more like this adult than this woman.
Right.
You know, cause I was just conscious of the separation between adults and children, not so much between genders.
Yeah.
So it didn't register really. So I grew up with it. It never felt odd to me. But it was a bad relationship. Like they just had a shitty, abusive relationship.
Your mom and your dad.
No, my mom and her partner.
Oh, and you were around that.
And I was around that, and that was just awful.
Yeah. And do you?
My point is that gay people are awful.
Yeah. Well, I
didn't know. I just wanted to make sure your listeners understood.
Well, they should. That's the name of my podcast. Welcome to Gay People Are Awful. We're also supported by the Trump Foundation. I assume you're sort of you sit more on the liberal side of things, sort of being brought up in sort of a very in that sort of environment. Do you think that informs some of your sort of views about life and sort of?
I mean, no doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm an East Coast Jew raised in a lesbian household. It's unlikely I'm going to end up being a conservative.
Or hunting.
It's not impossible, but it's unlikely.
Yeah.
And that is where I ended up pretty liberal.
Yeah. I mean, I know you went to...
Stage Door Manor.
Stage Door Manor, and then you went to NYU.
Yeah.
Was performing on the horizon for you when you were in high school?
I decided when I was 9.
Really?
I did a play at summer camp and was like, well, that's me. And then came home, told my mom, like, I'm going to be an actor. She's like, fine.
The response from the people?
I honestly don't even know what it was. I think I felt at home. I felt at home on stage. I felt at home among theater people. There was just something that felt right to me.
What is it about theater people in you that sort of meshed? Or
I don't know. I mean, I think it was my first time being around, for lack of a more specific word, creative people who were interested in sort of coming together and making something. That experience was new to me. And I think it's probably not so different from people who join a team and, you know, you're working together to win a championship. I think it felt like that. Obviously, I'm naturally gifted athletically.
Yes. You are the great white Jew.
That's right. But all of my sports, like when I won the U.S. Open in tennis, like I was a singles player. You know, I was never part of a team.
I get it. Because that works for you.
That works for me.
You are the Steph Curry of men's tennis. So you're an atheist, and I'm interested in this because I read this quote of yours that says, so, and you talk about marrying your wife who is
Catholic.
And so, yes, I would do it again. I would do it because, as confused as I am about matters of the heart and pretty much everything else, I do. Have some small earthly faith in this life I chose. life I sometimes do not recognize as my own.
You're reading this beautifully, by the way. Beautifully.
Thank you. I have a Tony Award. And what is it about your life that you don't recognize as your own? What do you mean by that? It's a pretty interesting statement to me.
I think... that book I open... with, I think, the best example of that feeling, which is, I use that Talking Heads quote, this is not my beautiful wife, or this is not my car, or whatever. Mm. Just that moment of looking around and going, I could not have possibly anticipated that this is where I would be in my life in this moment. And I don't know how I got here, and I don't know if this is even what I want. But somehow I find myself in these circumstances.
What was it about?
I had envisioned for myself at the age of 9 that I would be a kind of vagabond actor who goes from town to town and, you know, does regional theater and is poor and, you know, makes a kind of subsistence living and probably never gets married and never has kids and just devotes himself to the art.
Yeah.
And my life is so, in some ways, so much better than that.
Yeah.
But so different. I mean, I'm so settled. I'm so domestic. I have a house.
Has that scared you? Sometimes I get a little, you know, you get locked in and we got to put the kids through school and... It's funny, Leno said to me, never get tied up with things because then you're going to have to pay for those things and you're going to have to not be able to do your art when you want
to. He's got 5 airport hangers full of cars.
I know. And no kids. I know. So I try not to let... But you know what I mean? I mean, we're both parents with families. Do you go, okay...
Well, I'm in a constant state of financial anxiety.
Yes.
That, and exactly contrary to Leno's advice, I seem to only... acquire more things and more expensive things.
Right.
Part of that, I feel like, subconsciously, is I feel like I do that on some level to keep the motivation high. Like on some level, when you buy the house, you're sort of pushing all your chips into the middle of the table and you're going, well, fuck it, now I have to work.
Yeah.
I have to figure this out.
Yeah.
I think that's been motivating for me.
Yeah.
Just that panic. But at the same time, it's hard to live in a state of perpetual financial anxiety.
Well, that's it. I mean, you know, you wake up and you don't know if it's suddenly going to go away.
I know. And I've been waiting for it to go away for 20 years.
It just happened recently. Like, you know, whenever a club changes over bookers, there's a little of that. Because, okay, you're in and you're good and whatever. And you have credits and you have all that stuff. But then people have their... people, right?
Right.
And then there's that. And then you never, but I've seen interviews with major stars and it never goes away. And I just think it's the
I don't think it goes away to whatever level you're at.
I hate to say this, but I know you have to go, but Christ, we only scratched the surface. So you're going to come on again and do another one.
I'll do another one anytime.
You know, whether you're promoting anything or not.
I have no desire to promote. Promoting is the least of it for me.
Well, okay.
Good conversation with good friends.
There's so much I wanted to talk to you about, but we got to get you out of here.
I'm so sorry.
No. Well, you got a thing, and you're a big dickhead. So, Epics is the special. It's out. You also can get it on demand. You're going to see you in season 2 of Another Period on Comedy Central. You're in Jim Gaffigan's show.
That's where I have to go right now. That's why I have to go, because I have to go do a table read.
Funny. and a child's first book of Trump, which I can't rate for.
July 5th.
We got to talk about
this. You can pre-order it now.
Yeah, with the state. And I really meant it. You are the Dick Cavett of my
generation. I'll take it.
Writer, actor, performer.
Raconteur,
and fellow tea drinker. Thank you, buddy. It's great to see
you.
Thank
you, Paul.
Yeah, we're shaking hands on the podcast. All right.